Standard Issue for all women.
Hello there. Welcome to episode 20 of the Standard Issue Podzine. I'm Mickey Noonan, and I did not buy the letter written by Charles Manson I saw for sale at a Brooklyn flea market. I'm joined by...
I'm Hannah Dunleavy, and I once slept through an earthquake.
And I'm Jen Offord, and the stick bit in the end of a banana sort of freaks me out a bit.
It's unpleasant.
Do you know what I mean, though?
It's a bit umbilical cord.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's not helping.
No, it's going to make it worse.
Chew through that. Anyway. This Saturday, November the 25th, is the International Day to End Violence Against Women and Girls. And later on, Sam 14 chats to Katrina McHugh, the artistic director and writer at Open Class Theatre Company, about Key Change, which is the company's play devised and set in a women's prison.
Sounds interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really good.
With St Andrew's Day coming up, our resident Scottish person in England, Dottie Winters, talks about how you could possibly celebrate it if you're not actually in Scotland.
Good to know.
Myself and Carrie Ad Lloyd chat to Susan Wacoma about her play, or, well, the play she's in. I guess it's not really her play as such. I'll shut up now. Labour of Love, and about diversity in the world of acting. And our Sarah's got the answer to one of your life questions in Sarah Milliken's Question Time.
And I do Disney's Brave, which is also a sort of topical for St Andrew's Day.
We're going full Scottish.
We are.
I'm having a full Scottish.
Nobody
attempts. Square sausage and a bit of haggis.
Mm. Nobody's to attempt an accent.
If my mum were here, because she is half Scottish, I'd be going, go on, mum, do your Scottish accent. And she'd go, I can't do it no more. And then we'd all laugh at her, because we'd know that's what she's going to say.
Oh, laughing at mums, one of life's real joy. One of my Scottish friends who's from Glasgow taught me to say some really aggressive things in a Glaswegian accent, just in case I ever needed them. For example, once when somebody just walked out in front of me, really drunk, and I peeped my horn. Not in any other way than, like, mate, I'm going to hit you. And he, like, banged his hands, like, on the bonnet of my car, and he was really drunk, and I thought, this is the opportunity. So I opened down the window, and I shouted. I can't tell you what I shouted now, because even the language I use is it was quite extreme. And he looked terrified and walked off. And I thought, there you go, that worked. My random aggressive Scottish expressions was enough to make this guy think, she's crazy. I'm not fucking with her.
My friend Catherine had a toy that was given to her when she was at university, which was like this little pink felt kitten. And when you squeezed its belly, it went, bing, 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 meow, bing, 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 meow, bing, 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 meow, bing, 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 meow. It was very, very cute. And we called it the space kitten. And we loved the noise it made to the extent that I once recorded it and made it my ringtone on my phone. And I was coming back from a football match once with my brother, and my phone went off and loads of Scottish men were on the train and they laughed at me. And I went, oh, it's space kitten. And this man went, space kitten, what the fuck is that? And then he said, there was a bit of hullabaloo about who was going to sit down. And he goes, you can sit down because you've got a shit ringtone.
More Scottishness later. But first, victim blaming, the Eurovision Song Contest, and a lesson in how not to celebrate women. It's time for the Bush Telegraph. Cue Sting.
Bush Telegraph.
Welcome to the Bush Telegraph, where we stare at the news like it's a sausage roll in a nativity scene.
Now I'm hungry. Finally, the moment we've all been waiting for has happened. Morrissey weighed in on the whole Weinstein / Spacey / dickwad shit blizzard. Irish blood, English heart, and fuck all sense or sensitivity, Moz was, predictably, a colossal sphincter. According to the former Smiths frontman, the real people at fault here are, you guessed it, the victims. Because Morrissey... sigh. People know exactly what's going on, and they play along, he claimed. Presumably while tapping out November spawned a monster on his perfectly bendy banana. If it had given them a great career, they would not talk about it, continued. On some occasions, the person referred to as a victim is merely disappointed.
Sure.
There's no doubt that Moz has penned some truly great songs, made so by the wit and compassion that underlies them. Where those qualities have gone now is anyone's guess. These days, he's throwing his arms around Kevin and Harvey, as well as Nigel and UKIP. It's been in the post a while, but it's definitely time for Johnny Marr to ban Morrissey from being a Smiths fan.
Actress and writer Lena Dunham has issued an apology. There's a sentence you end up saying a lot. after she put out a statement questioning one woman's story of sexual assault. Dunham and Girls co-showrunner Jenny Connor posted a statement about allegations against Murray Miller, a writer and producer on Girls, by actor Aurora Perrineau, who filed a report with the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department alleging that Miller had assaulted her in 2012 when she was 17. Miller denied the allegations. The pair, that's Connor and Dunham, put out a statement that said, "While our first instinct is to listen to every woman's story, our insider knowledge of Murray's situation makes us confident that, sadly, this accusation is one of the 3% of assault cases that are misreported every year. It is a true shame to add to that number, as outside of Hollywood, women still struggle to be believed. We stand by Murray, and this is all we will be saying on this issue. Fat chance." Dunham later called her statement naive, which isn't the word I was looking for, as much as a fucking disgrace.
Fucking hell, yeah. That is just like...
It's really bad.
Oh, well, we've got insider knowledge because we like this man and he's important to us, so we can't have done it. Sorry, lads, it's just not the way it works, is it?
I've got a certain empathy for the situation in that, you know, I've got men I'm close to, I've got a brother, I've got people that I would be horrified, absolutely horrified, if they were accused of something, and my gut would be screaming at me, they didn't do it, they're not that sort of guy. I mean, for a start, I don't have the sort of power that Lena Dunham has of me making a statement anyway, but there's absolutely no way that I would put a statement out. Not just saying this isn't true, but pointing out that women lie all the time, which is what that statement also says.
She's a woman who's always talking about how women need to be heard, women need to be believed. Like the point, the really big crime, I think, in what she's done is suggesting that there is an element of doubt in any of these stories. That's to me, is the real fucking kick in the junk.
I just assume she's been listening to a hell of a lot of Morrissey recently, possibly his new album.
Probably.
Because what she's saying is eventually, we're going to hit a point, I think, where 100 women come out and talk about Harvey Weinstein, because we are reaching that figure.
So what she said is
three of them are lying.
It's absolutely preposterous.
Can we have some good news on the sexual harassment front, please, Jen?
Well, fortunately, Mickey, yes, she can.
Thanks, mate.
Last week, proving he is woke AF. That's as fuck, guys, in case you didn't crack
Jen speaks internet.
I do. Yeah, I do.
As
the only millennial in the room, I am just. Thank you. Anyway, everyone's favourite erstwhile Canadian teen star and hip-hop supremo, Drake, or as I'm now calling him, Snow Drake.
Is this because my mate's got a Christmas jumper with Drake on it that I sent you a picture of?
It is partly that, and also partly because of the sentiment I will now express. Okay. So he made the news after squaring up to a sex pest at one of his gigs, spotting a man in the crowd putting his hands where they were not invited. Drake stopped his performance to call the shit weasel out. At a Sydney gig, he was filmed addressing the audience member thus: "If you don't stop touching girls, I'm going to come out there and fuck you up."
That's an excellent Drake impression.
Yeah, Jen. I thought so. It's the...
It was like he was in the room.
Yeah, it's the... I don't know what he sounds like, so I didn't want to... Like a Canadian, I imagine, but who knows. It's very difficult to tell, because if you listen to his songs, sometimes he sounds like a pretend Caribbean person. Sometimes he sounds...
If he's a Canadian, then what he would say is, I'm going to come out there and fuck you up.
Yeah. But sometimes he also sounds like he's from the southern states of the US. You never know what you're going to get. It depends very much on the era of Drake music. But anyway, for clarity, he then added, "If you don't stop putting your hands on girls, I'm going to come out there and fuck your ass up." Don't know about you, lads, but that is making my hotline bling a little bit.
I don't know what that means, Jen.
It actually doesn't make sense in the context of this at all, because it's a booty call. But
is that a Drake song?
It is, yeah.
Okay, see, I'm just looking at you wide-eyed and innocent and going...
It's the one with the dance. Oh, fuck it.
Yeah, enough
God.
With your new talk, millennial.
Doesn't ignorant stare not translate to a podcast? Because I'm just staring at Jen going, what is this Drake music you
speak never of? Heard of Hotline Bling?
Okay, I've got a question. Okay. Have we ever been more divided as a nation?
I don't know. Some of us know what Hotline Bling is.
Who knows? I mean, maybe it was the War of the Roses. Maybe it was a civil war. Who knows? But a YouGov survey last week revealed some very clear differences about Leave and Remain voters on a whole range of subjects. How do you like your steaks cooked, colleagues?
Rare.
Okay, I'm a medium rare. You two are rare. That means we are Remainers.
Oh, that is true.
Yeah.
Wow.
Reckon gollywogs are offensive?
Yes, I do.
Pretty much.
Yeah, me too.
I mean, and by pretty much, I mean absolutely.
Then we are Remainers.
This is true again.
Yeah. Think that Trump might still be a good president?
No.
No.
If you do, it means you're a Leave voter. And possibly on crack. Remainers are also apparently more likely to believe that we should leave the Eurovision Song Contest, to which I can only say, maybe we should have had a fucking referendum on that instead.
Do you think Ireland would have won? The winner of the referendum is Ireland. What?
Every time.
With my lovely horse.
To be fair, Ireland has lost this referendum, like you wouldn't believe. Yeah.
They have been shat all over. Yeah. Oh, sorry, Ireland.
I was once, I have told you this story before, I think, but I'm going to tell it again. I was once on the Isle of Wight on a little holiday. And for some reason, in the Isle of Wight, they still sell like quite a lot of gollywog paraphernalia.
Also in
gift
like
shops.
A lot of places on the coast of Yorkshire, mate. Like Whitby, really? Robin Hood's Bay, Scarborough. It's like the 50s.
Yeah, there's a lot of this going on. And I was in a gift shop, obviously pointing these out to my friends from London, going, what the fuck is all this about? And a man says, there's like a sort of middle-aged couple in the gift shop, and a man says to his wife, look, it's a gollywog. And she said, you're not to call it that anymore, you're to call it a cuddly tie.
I think I've seen her on the Generation Game. Just a conveyor belt of gollywogs.
Where do you think they stand on the spectrum of Leave and Remain?
I bet they have their steak well crispy.
Yeah.
Well crispy steaks.
Anyway, in news that surprised no one, or at least anyone with a rudimentary understanding of economics, which apparently excludes at least one of the last two Tory chancellors of the Exchequer, austerity hits poor people the hardest.
Fucking hell, that's a surprise, isn't it?
Anyone know? No.
Really?
Yeah, no, it's unbelievable, isn't it? But specifically, disabled people, single parents, ethnic minority households and women, according to a report last week by the Equalities Watchdog. In fact, the poorest 10% of households will lose, on average, 10% of their income by 2022, which seems fair, right? Yeah?
Sure.
Sure. So the news came as a report by academics at University College London also suggested a link between restrictions on health and social care and a rise in deaths. Yeah, so an estimated 120,000 additional deaths between 2010 and 2017, in fact. Which is quite a lot, isn't it? Any such stats, obviously, need to be treated with caution because, of course, they're all estimates. But you don't have to be a genius to work out that if you deprive the most vulnerable people of essential services, nothing good is going to come from that, is it? So apart from, you know, you can potentially afford to give better tax breaks to your business pals or those dudes from Qatar buying up every empty flat in London.
Indeed.
Yeah.
The American Music Awards, a ceremony fairly well known for reacting to the political climate, see Green Day's anti-Trump song last year, took place on November the 19th and promised to champion, in inverted commas, earth-shattering women. It then proceeded to give most of the gongs to young white men. Just one woman won an award, as Lady Gaga picked up the favourite female pop/rock artist prize. So yeah, a woman won the category specifically for women, and the rest of the birds got diddly squat. Perhaps unsurprising, given only 3 of the 30-plus nominees were women. I am rolling my eyes so hard, I'm in danger of becoming that fish off of Blue Planet that can see through the top of its own head. Try harder, AMAs. Try much, much harder.
Well, you have equal pay, but, you know, they're not equal, are they?
Sexism of the week.
It's that time of the week where we womanfully step up and do something that's actually our job anyway.
Women, eh? Just what are we good for? Well, stats consistently show that women are the major and often unpaid providers of long-term care. So that's something, isn't it? Perhaps then, it's not surprising that a paediatric surgeon at Royal Preston Hospital decided that a man bringing his 3-year-old daughter to an appointment was noteworthy, as in he literally wrote a letter congratulating the chap. Quote, unfortunately, her mum could not be at the clinic visit today as she has not been well, and father stepped in manfully, read the letter sent to Joe and Billy Martin. Let's quickly read between the lines, because the underlying message isn't too hard to see. Well done, Billy, looking after your own kid. What a hero. I bet you babysit her and take her to the park and everything. The Martins were rightly irritated by the note, pointing out that the doctor should probably assume that fathers and mothers have equal responsibility for taking their children to hospital appointments, because, you know, Fathers and mothers have equal responsibility for taking their children to hospital appointments.
We're all in universal agreement with that one.
Good meeting, guys.
Yeah,
thanks.
Hold on. I think it's interesting. I've seen dudes on Facebook, you know, like friends on Facebook, saying they get fucked off when people say, oh, you're babysitting tonight, are you? It's like, no, I'm just being a parent tonight. Yeah. like I usually am. Goes both ways, doesn't it?
Yeah. I'm here with Cariad Lloyd and Susan Wacoma, the star of a West End play. I'm looking at you, Cariad.
I can confirm that Susan is the star of a West End play.
Yes.
You. Yeah. We just saw it.
We did just see it. It's called Labour of Love.
Labour of Love. Do you know what? I nearly just said Love's Labour's Lost.
You are not the first. My mate was like, oh, I'm not going to come and see your play. And I was like, oh, that's rude.
Yeah.
And she was like, no, I can't deal with Shakespeare. I was like, it's not. What do you think it is? Love's Labour's Lost. I was like, no, it isn't. It's Labour of Love. It's brand new. She's like, nah. She still hasn't come.
She's still got 3 more weeks.
Just tell her you're also doing Love's Labour's Lost.
At the same time, in rep.
Susan is the star of Labour of Love, which is a very brilliant play we just watched.
We did just watch it. In fact, I'm not going to tell you what it's about. I'm going to ask you, Susan, can you tell us what it's about, please, the play that you're in?
The play that I'm in, in the West End.
Doing my West End debut thing.
Is it your debut?
It's my debut.
That's congratulations. Exciting.
Thanks. It's looking at the Labour Party over 27 years. And it's looking at a town in North Midlands, so we're away from London. And so it spans from the last general election this year, going back to 1990. And sort of looking at the history of the Labour Party and, you know, the sort of big fight between centrists and people who are on the far left, I guess. And Tamsin Gregg and Mark Freeman, who star in it, they play like two people who are from opposite sides. So she's very much sort of staunch Labourite on the left, and he's more sort of your Blair centrist, and how they work together. That's what about. And it's comedy.
Yeah, it's very funny.
it's really funny.
You have to say
when you say it's about the history of the Labour Party, it can sound, but it's really, really funny. And it's also really about the history of this country in a way.
Yeah.
It's sort of covered, because it's not just Labour, obviously they're talking about the Tories and Margaret Thatcher and how it has affected, like you said, a small Midlands town.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I thought it was absolutely fascinating. There you go, that's my review.
Brilliant, thank you.
Absolutely fascinating. Also,
absolutely fascinating.
Absolutely fascinating. Put on the poster.
Yeah. It's not only your West End debut here, you've also just sort of won something, haven't you? Or you've been named as as a breakthrough Brit by BAFTA.
Yeah.
It's so exciting.
Yeah. It's really nice.
Yeah.
It's really nice. It's weird because that's to do with telly and stuff. And this is, so it did feel very separate. Like we had, there's a big ceremony last Wednesday, and in the run up to it, we did all this press and met all these great people, and it is actually genuinely brilliant because it's about mentorship. So for a year, for 12 months, we get to liaise with BAFTA with people that we want to speak to, who can give us advice. So I'm looking to write a lot more. So for me, it's going to be speaking to writers and creators and producers, and that's all at your fingertips. You're a member for a year. You get to go to loads of talks and stuff. It's like a real. You're not just on the list saying you're going to hopefully do well. Like, it's, they give you loads of tools for that to happen.
Mm. I read an interview that you did with The Guardian, I think, quite recently. You have started writing more partly because you felt that there were not enough roles for not white people, women.
Yeah, it's completely, there's no men. There's no men in my script. So, I've been commissioned to write a pilot. And I think there's a man who turns up in like episode 3, but I'm only writing the pilot, so it's just women. It wasn't strictly, oh, there isn't enough roles. There are enough roles if you're happy just having one line, if you're happy just sort of shuffling in and out of one scene. There is such a difference when you're in a series and you've helped create a role in some sense, whether it's just it's coming out of your mouth, compared to those experiences that I've had, which is, you know, a day on set and that's it. I feel like it's one of the only ways that you get better and you get to know yourself as an actor is if you do it. And so there was just a point in my career where I was like, I could pay rent just literally doing bit parts all the time.
Well, I just feel like the idea of what a lead actor, actress is just, I don't fit into that of a lot of things. And that's rubbish.
Yeah.
And so you just sort of go, well, I could
moan, and I was just at a point where I had enough of trying to convince people that I was talented enough or that I could do. I saw punts happening to so many of my male friends out of drama school. It was like, oh, he's just out of drama school, of course he can play Hamlet. Mm. I have to jump through hoops in order to do like one measly scene. And you can play that game and you can try and fight that, but I got to a point where I was like, yeah, I'm not interested in fighting that, I'll try my own stuff. And that was with the encouragement of Phoebe Waller-Bridge, who's a good friend of mine, and Michaela and lots of other women who were just going, I'm just going to do it myself.
How was it being part of something like Chewing Gum, which is an incredible series? We were talking about it before, and I think, like you said, Phoebe's Fleabag and then Michaela doing Chewing Gum, it did feel like this tide was changing.
Yeah.
And you were watching a show completely driven by a woman, not, oh, she's an amazing actor and someone else wrote this.
Yeah.
Like, she wrote it, she's in it. Like, it must have been incredible. Did it feel quite exciting to be part of it at the time?
It did, because these were women whose foundation was theatre.
Mm.
So Chewing Gum came from a one-woman show. Fleabag came from a one-woman show. I met Phoebe doing Crashing, which was her first series that she'd written. And she had this very well-known theatre company. That was how I knew Phoebe. I didn't know her as a television anything. Hadn't seen her at all on television. And so what was exciting about that, what is exciting about that, is that you're having women who are skilled. You know that these women are in a room and someone could probably try and tell them how to do it, and you know that they have the strength to go, no.
Mm.
Actually, no, I know what I've been doing long enough, because I've been creating this and doing this before you realised that I was probably worth investing in. And that is what's really exciting.
I read that article that you, loads of people retweeted it. It was really good. That Sarah, can't say her surname.
Oh, Sarah Soleimani wrote.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was really good.
Yeah.
I thought she wrote that very brilliantly.
That was very, very interesting about how in America so many more women are in writers' rooms because women watch TV.
Yeah.
Women are in control, usually, of like the household purse and things like that.
It's kind of incredible that it's only just happening. But definitely, also, American television works completely differently. They have writers' rooms, so they may have 20 writers.
Uh-huh.
So in the past, you would have had 20 white men writing that.
Mm.
And so eventually, of course, they're driven completely by advertising. So they're like, oh, we should get some women in so we can write some good female characters who will watch this, so they will watch the adverts. Like,
it's all money.
Yeah, it's all money.
And you sort of want it to be a kind of social change.
Yeah, yeah.
But it isn't, it's just business.
It's business, but they're better at business, I think, than we are.
Presumably in the States, then, also, there are more not white people in writers' rooms as well.
Yes.
I think so, yeah, I wouldn't know.
Hands down.
Yeah.
You would think that given, you know, the demographics of the US, you would definitely think that would be the case. If it's driven by money and you're...
Well, one of my really good friends is a writer, and she was struggling here for years, and couldn't, like, some of the stories that I... And she, she's from, like, a quite well-off family. She went to Oxford. Like, sort of, if she was a white man, like, she would be commissioning something, But nothing happened, and about 2 years ago, she got a job through our own sort of efforts, joining the writers' room for How to Get Away with Murder. And so she literally, over a week, she had to pack her life and go and live in LA. And I've seen her quite a few times, and obviously there's, you know, with any job, there are some gripes or there's some things that she doesn't quite understand, but she's like, they just make it worth your while.
Mm.
Because over here in the UK, you will work the same amount and you've got nothing to show for it. So in the end, if you're not living off, you know, mum's dollar or dad's dollar or whatever, you have to give up. Whereas there, you do one job and you know that you can focus and give all your energy on it, because you don't need to worry about your rent, you don't need to worry about this, because it's just a bigger business. And she's like, it shouldn't matter, but it does, because ultimately, if you can't afford to write, then you stop writing.
It's the same across all of the arts, though, isn't it?
Yeah,
because it's such a competitive... And the same in politics as well, actually, because it's so competitive to get into these things. You can't do it unless you can afford to work for free.
Precisely.
And then that's the problem with everyone at the top is the same, because they're all from the same background.
Yeah. Mm.
I think that's really exciting, though, that I do feel like it's changing, and I do feel like I loved Chewing Gum. And then the other one, I haven't watched Crazy Head, but you've watched Crazy Head.
Yeah, I spoke to you about this before.
Yeah, I know,
because I really loved it. I always say that
as a teenager, the character that I identified with was Buffy the Vampire Slayer, which is weird because I never put a stake for a vampire's heart or anything. But
anyway, crazy head.
Crazy head. I really liked it. So, Buffy, I was really into that when I was a kid, and I think that every teenage girl should have a Buffy. You're one of the lead roles in it. It's pretty good.
Yes, it
was really good. It was really well written. It was really funny. And I thought it was really responsibly cast as well. So
For example,
your brother in the show, he's a very attractive young man, and he plays quite dull, nice guy.
Yeah.
Which kind of like felt almost out of place.
Yeah.
It's like you're not playing attractive.
Hang on. There was some thought to that.
Yeah.
You look at him, you think, oh right, so he's gonna turn up and make shit like wild, and he just is a really nice brother.
Yeah.
A really nice brother who we have to like put aside as we go and like get some demons.
Yeah, and I thought
like
it was
we've
really
got to drug him and be like, go to sleep. Literally. It's almost like we were like having the importance of diversity to allow to play all different characters and to allow a boring character not to be, like you said, those traditional roles that not white actors are being forced into playing.
Because you hear it all the time, don't you, of actors going to America, like Riz Ahmed, for example, saying he just only ever got offered roles as a terrorist.
Yeah. And the thing is, it's fine for Riz Ahmed to play a terrorist if there are other roles for him to play. I went up for something and it was to play like a baddie in it. And I had a friend who was also going up for the role who's like, oh no, I don't really want to play a baddie because I don't want like black person to be seen as a baddie. I was like, I really want to play a baddie. Like, how fun would that be?
Yeah.
But it's the only reason why we have to check ourselves, which I think is really annoying, is because you go, oh, but there's not enough diversity.
Mm.
Like, I remember in Crashing, I was playing quite a sexy character. But because that's so far away from what I've ever been cast as, I was just like, it's a character, it's fine.
Mm.
But I remember some people sort of thinking, you know, oh, you know, isn't it weird playing those sort of characters? I was like, as long as there's diversity, you can have people who are not bright. You can have people who are confident sexually or use sex for something else. Or do you know what? Like, all that can exist. It's when you keep seeing the same thing.
Mm.
That you're like, then it gets toxic and that's when it gets a bit messy. But everything should exist, I think.
It's important for people to see positive roles. Is it annoying constantly being asked, talk to us about diversity in TV? Is that actually like a bit like, I just want to do my job?
Well, do you know what? Yeah, you're just like, I just want to get on with it, but there's a problem, so you have to talk about it. What I do feel sometimes, even though things have got better, you know, for instance, you look at Chewing Gum or you look at Insecure, there is a sort of notion of there's one, so it's fine.
There's
one that exists, so it's fine. The problem's been fixed. And it's like, no, it's when we talk about diversity, it means so much more.
Yeah.
And I do think that there is a habit sometimes of certain people patting themselves on the back going, well, we have one. It's like, that's not what diversity is.
Well, it's like the women in comedy thing.
Yeah,
there's one on the panel, great.
Done.
Congratulations, everyone goes home happy. But it's like, that's not what the world looks like. Well, like, I think it's about the casting, isn't it? It's to challenge every cast and be like, okay, well, why are we casting that as a non-white actor? And why are we not seeing, why can't Hamlet be from any background, gender, colour? Like, that's what we need to look at. And it is hard because, of course, culturally, we've all watched the same programmes, we've all seen the same roles. It does take your brain time to go, oh, yeah, a woman could do that. Actor who's not white could do that.
I think the quickest way to subvert that is by people making the decisions being diverse groups of people.
Yeah, of course.
I think that's the quickest way, because there'll be someone in the room who goes, haven't you thought about this?
Yeah.
Mm.
That will be foolproof.
Sarah Pascoe, who we chatted to, or rather you chatted to, and I sat and recorded you and told you to move the microphone away from the mouth. So Sarah just adapted Pride and Prejudice for Notting Hill Playhouse. And they specifically went for complete diverse casting.
Mm-hmm.
And they very much wanted, because Sarah was like, no one in the book ever says that they're white. It's never mentioned, so why can't they be? And we talked about, they talked about that they've been controversy, but it's not a non-white Lizzie Bennet.
Oh, gosh.
Again, at the time, surprised me, but then you both schooled me of like, carry on, people get pissed off about
it. It's because me and Sarah are from Essex, so we know those people are out there.
Yeah.
But also, you see it quite a lot.
I said at the time, you know, the whole like Idris Elba being James Bond.
Yeah, it really rattles people. Like,
it's not the character, but it's not quite right. It's like when John Boyega was announced he's going to be a stormtrooper, and everyone's like,
no.
How could, is that really?
Did they?
Star Wars?
But I do think when it comes to the thing that I find funny and why I love Crazy Head is like when it comes to sort of supernatural or sci-fi or whatever, like if there is ever a universe which could be diverse, it's that one. And so it really makes me laugh when people go, but no, because you're like, these things aren't real.
They're talking robots. Like there is a man who's just a Wookiee. Like,
yeah.
What is a Wookiee?
Yeah,
I
don't know. I literally couldn't tell you. That's the thing. It's sort of like, oh, you know, if we have
a, you know, diversity, whether it's, oh, you know, there's this person who's in a wheelchair and they're in this show, is it saying something? You just, that's what people get scared about, is that they think that viewers will watch something and go, why? What sort of political statement are they trying to make by that person being in it? And you just sort of go, no, there's no, no, they're all, because they have talent, people have talent, and you just have to trust that.
So okay. How long is the play running for, and where can our listeners see it?
You can, well, it's running until the 2nd of December, so we've only got a few weeks left. You can go on the website, Labour of Love, the play, Google it. It's there, Noel Coward Theatre, and we have, the most important thing, we have £10 day seats every day from 10:30, so you can get really, really brilliant seats for only a tenner.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Excellent. And is there anything else coming up? Where else might
we
see
you? Where can
we
follow you
in
on
the
social
media? I'm probably just see me on Twitter. Anyway, it's Susan _ we're going back. Yes, there is one other thing. I just did a pilot with Matt Berry and...
another historical...
It's the first corset I've ever worn.
I
put it on and I was like, you can keep this.
Yeah.
I don't want it. It fucking hurts. It has a couple of working titles, and it's about a Victorian murder squad. Mm-hmm. So it was
excellent.
Yeah.
Susan McComber, thank you very much.
And you,
Carriad, for your eyes all the fucking time.
At Lady Carriad, guys, or at Carriad Lloyd for Instagram stories.
Yeah, they know.
Hello, Dottie Winters here with my top tips for St Andrew's Day. It is a well-known fact that nothing makes us prouder of our country of origin than a decision to spend our lives many miles away from it. Overall, we Brits have an uneasy relationship with open displays of patriotism. We tend to leave it to the Americans, like customer service, mass shootings and pumpkin spicing all of the foods. But there is lots we can learn from our American cousins, not least that you don't really have to be very Scottish at all to claim it as your heritage and use it as an excuse to high camp it up while mainlining tenants lager. As St Andrew's Day approaches, Scottish people across the globe will be being 46% more Scottish than usual in celebration of our national saint. Meanwhile, in Scotland, it is testament to the strength of feeling about St Andrew's Day that it's now marked as a bank holiday, albeit one where the banks are still open and where employers aren't required to give anyone any time off. That's right, nothing smashes Scottish stereotypes more effectively than the world's most penny-pinching public holiday. UK Saints' Days have a distinctive flavour, familiar to all of us. St Patrick's Day is celebrated with unrestrained drinking whilst painted green. St David's Day is a festival of leeks, daffodils and fancy dress. St George's is a day for whinging about our lack of bank holidays and trying to find a talk show that isn't discussing whether or not our flag is racist. And of course, we celebrate St Andrew's Day Nope, I've got nothing. No fucker knows. This is great news for Scottish people, or people who have Scottish ancestry, or even people who just prefer their team sports to be as violent as possible. St Andrew's Day is a day with almost no traditions, which means we can celebrate it however we like and threaten to nut anyone who disagrees. Here are my top tips on how to celebrate the shit out of St Andy. Tip 1. Do what loads of people do and just have a practice Burns night. No bugger will know the difference and you get double haggis. If you prefer your haggis without neeps, go wild and stick it in a cheese toastie or a tiramisu. Follow up with as many Tunnocks tea cakes as you can manage, and remember, they are mainly air, so you don't need to include them on MyFitnessPal. Tip 2. Wear flat shoes and get angry if anyone challenges you on anything. According to ex-Scotland football manager Gordon Strachan recently, the men's team's lack of success was due to their diminutive height. He claimed that we Scots are genetically disadvantaged in this regard. This clearly isn't true. Just ask actual giants Nicola Sturgeon, Ruth Davidson and Jeanette Cranky. But the 30th November is as good a day as any to get your excuses in early. Tip 3. Cosplay at Comic-Con, but as the Bruins. Everyone will think you're so cool that you are into something they haven't discovered yet. They'll probably throw you a parade. Tip 4. Spend all day pointing at shit and telling people that Scotland invented it. That telly, that steam train, the telephone, sticky stamps, rainfall, violence, Oxbow Lakes, your mother. Tip 5. Tell everyone that John Barrowman is Welsh. He may be adorable, but keeping him entertained is exhausting. Someone else needs to take a turn for a bit. Tip 6. Declare yourself independent. Look, we all know referendums are hard, not to mention expensive and a logistical nightmare. Limit the hassle by undertaking a small-scale pilot. Ask yourself if you're independent. If you are, accept the result and sing Independent Women by Destiny's Child for the rest of the day. Tip 7. Strip naked and yell about freedom. Across the globe, William Wallace is one of our best known figureheads. Sadly, mainly the Braveheart version. Show everyone how to do it better by painting your nudie-doody self blue and shouting a lot, but by not being Mel Gibson or an anti-Semite. Sure, you'll get some funny looks, but I guarantee the other mums on the school run won't try to talk to you about the Christmas fair. Tip 8. Remind anyone who will listen that our national animal is the mother-flipping unicorn. That's right, folks, we were well into unicorns long before they were cool. Cover yourself in Pritt Stick and run through Claire's accessories until you're covered in sparkly unicorns. Job done. Tip 9. Have some more Tunnock's tea cakes just to be safe. Not the wafer biscuits, though. They are wrong. Just the tea cakes. Tip 10. Swear all fucking day. Scottish people invented swearing. Right. That should do it. Let's do all these things and start some new traditions. I reckon initially we might have to style it out a bit to get these customs properly embedded. But just pull on your big girl tartan pants, pack up your cagoule, and remember to threaten to nut anyone who stands in the way of our glorious celebration. Happy St Andrew's Day. Dotty out.
Question.
I'm not answering that.
Hello, this is Sarah Millican and you are listening to Sarah Millican's Question Time. If you hear a slight rustling while I'm chatting to you, that's because I am currently getting my hair done and I am wearing one of those kind of black plastic things around my neck. So if you hear rustling and you think, is she in some leaves? Is she beside a squirrel? It's not. It's because I'm wearing a fucking cape. I am some kind of superhero with excellent roots, or will soon have excellent roots. The question that I got this week from is from Lucy Daniels on Twitter. And the question, it's a really interesting one for me, is why no cheese? That's the whole question. Why no cheese? Now, that's not something that really comes up for me, because you've said that really confidently, Lucy, as if you think that both of those are a viable option. How little you know me, Lucy Daniels, off of the Twitter. I don't like wine or cheese. So the only time I'd ever say why no cheese is if somebody said to me, oh God, what would you hate if you had to eat something? What would be the worst things you'd have to eat? And I'd go, why not cheese? Cheese is just the scrapings of an old man's sock put on a cracker, and wine is petrol in a glass. So I put to you a different question. My answer to your question, Lucy, is no, neither. But my question to you, if I may be so bold, is juice or butter? So you could have Ribena if you want to pretend you have, or like Vimto if you want to pretend you're having wine, but you could have any kind of juice, apple, orange, cranberry if you've got problems with your nethers. My sister once told me that cranberry juice was good for cystitis, and I remember genuinely thinking, it's really expensive, that's going to be really, really mad expensive to fill a bath, because I thought you had to dunk your fanny in it. I didn't realise you just drank it and it went through the other way. Is that too much? No. So you can have any kind of juice. And butter, I mean, if somebody said to you at the end of a meal, do you want a pudding or do you want just like some butter in your hand? I think that would be a tricky choice, and I'll bloody love a pudding. So my question to you, Lucy Daniels, and feel free to reply to me on the Twitter, I'll keep an eye out for it, is juice or butter? Thank you very much for your questions this week, guys. Take care. Bye. If you'd like me to answer one of your questions, then tweet us at StandardIssueUK using the hashtag SMQT. Thank you.
standard issue for all women.
I miss my kids, a bath, money. I miss cocaine, warm food. I miss my dog, my shopping, drink, my drinking, driving, drugs.
I miss landscapes.
The sea. The sky. I miss my friends.
I miss being good to me.
I miss going to nice places.
I miss change.
Warm food. Getting stuff done.
Being treated with respect.
Hello, I'm Sam Onefour, and that was an extract from Key Change, a powerful play from all-female theatre company Open Clasp, which was devised and developed with women inmates from Low Newton Prison in the North East. It premiered in 2015, touring male prisons before going to Edinburgh, New York, the Houses of Parliament, and then going on to a sellout UK tour. And now, the piece is set to go truly global when it's streamed as part of the United Nations campaign to end violence against women on November the 25th. Since co-founding the company in 1998, Katrina McHugh has been forging ahead with its goal to change the world for the better, one play at a time. I caught up with the very fast-talking Katrina to talk about Key Change at Open Clasp's offices at the West End Women and Girls Centre in Newcastle. It was just a few days after she'd been to the Palace to pick up her MBE for services to disadvantaged women.
I accepted that MBE on behalf of all the women that had put their trust in the company over the last 19 years. It was 19 years this year. So I was really honoured to accept the award. And actually, surprisingly, I was quite emotional in the moment. And I was really nervous. I was more nervous than I thought I was going to be and more overwhelmed than I thought I was going to be. I did the kids, you know, I went over to her. And then she was putting the medal on and I prepared what I was going to say and I was all... I'm going to tell her about Key Change. I'd heard she tweeted as well, has done once. So I turned around and I said, look, Joanne, you must be really proud. And I was going, we have just been on this massive journey. I said, we won the Best of Edinburgh. I said, we ended up in New York. And now we're about to go global with the backing of the United Nations. And she went, really? She said, it's gone that big. And I was going, yeah, it's gone really big. And I was like, I hear your tweet. And I was like, would you mind tweeting about the show? And I don't really remember what she said back. And I think she laughed and shook my hand. And everybody said she was laughing when she was talking. Just out of my box, totally, in terms of what was expected of me when I left school at 16.
Yeah.
And then to be in the palace, meeting the Queen, getting a medal on behalf of all the women that we'd worked with. I was all, it was just the surrealist moment. But I managed not to fall over. I managed to put my Doc Martin boots on when I got to the palace gates. I managed to leave, had a few food, drank champagne.
Sounds perfect.
It was great. It was really good. But the whole thing about Key Change, and you know, it started from a really small project, and then it's turned into this kind of huge project.
But it's kind of 3 years now, isn't it? Since it's 2014.
Yeah.
So, did you have any kind of ambitions for it in terms of now what's happened?
No, not in the moment, because we had a brief, so it was somebody else's idea, and so we were kind of given the brief to go into the prison, to work with the women, to support them to create and perform a show, and then for us to take that show out of the prison and then tour it to men's prisons. It's a short project in its entirety. It's from the January, and we finished the beginning of June of that year. We met them in the chapel on the Friday each week, and then we just put our faith in the methodology of the company in terms of the drama techniques that we would use to create a safe space for discussion. And we just started and we took every session and we were just in the moment. So what happens in this session? What happens in the next session? What do you want to do next week? What do you want to look at? And then they created, the first character was Lucy, and they pulled on their own experiences to create Lucy. But, you know, our job was to make sure that they trusted us and trusted each other to share their own experiences of their lives. We had no idea what they were going to say to us, what they were going to share, because, and everything in terms of how the company works, always led by the women. It's always led by the women and girls, whatever they want to talk about. And they went, we don't want to talk about prison, and we don't want to talk about domestic violence. We didn't think about the product, and we never do as an organisation. We just think about the moment when we're with the women, and they are the most important people in that room, and they are the experts in their own experiences. It was 8 sessions, so 4 days and 8 sessions, and then I stopped and wrote the first draft of that play in a week. The women then were offered the opportunity to perform. It was a team of us kind of supporting the women then to put it up on its feet, and they were always at the forefront of the performance inside the prison, and we were there to support that. They performed it to the women in the prison. The women had trusted her so much, they talked about domestic violence and they talked about life in prison.
So when you say, to begin with, they said, we don't want to talk about domestic violence, was domestic violence part of the brief?
I think the hope for the people who commissioned it, which was Dilly Arts as an organisation who commissioned it, I think their hope would be that that's what would be highlighted in the piece. But we didn't lead on that. We did, kind of didn't go, this is what the play needs to be about, because that's not how we work. In all the 19 years of the company's life, every time we go into a community, we don't go in with an issue, but we always come up with the issue of domestic violence. And it was a common kind of theme within the group of women we worked with. There's a lot of kind of research which goes, there's a direct link between domestic violence and life in prison. And when we were working with the women, you could see their different journeys. There was two characters, core characters in the group. So one was Lucy, the face character, and then we had the character of Angie created. And she was created because when the women, some of the women had been kicked out at 16, had experienced abuse as children. I'm not saying it's all women, obviously, but they had used heroin. So some of the women in the group had used heroin, some of the women hadn't. So then they become, some of the women go, and, well, Lucy would never use heroin, and some of the women go, well, Lucy would use heroin. So then they created Angie. So they had some space to talk about their use of heroin and how that had kind of informed their life journey as well. So Angie has multiple partners who perpetrate domestic violence against her. She gets involved in sex work. So you can map her journey. So at 16, she miscarries the baby. She's offered heroin by other people who are 16. Does young people go and have this drug, it'll make you feel better? She smokes the first bit of heroin, gets involved in the heroin, then gets involved in multiple partners. So the kind of journey goes that way. And then Lucy's character, she meets somebody, she falls in love with this person, he's older than her, she thinks this is going to be okay. Then he perpetrates violence against her. So that represented the kind of ripple within the room in terms of both of their experiences.
So they performed, the women themselves performed it for their fellow inmates.
And that was brilliant. And you hear one of the women who's on the 25th of November, where obviously it's going to be the screening of Key Change is going to be at the Tanside Cinema, and Cheryl Byron's going to be there. So she's out of prison now, and she was one of our performers in the piece, and she was amazing in the piece, as were the other women. But what you can hear her say is that when she, after the performance, she went back into the prison, because I interviewed her when she came out. And I said, what was it like? And she just walked in and she became the theatre maker. No longer the prisoner, no longer the offender, but the theatre maker. And her shoulders were high. And she walked around with pride inside that prison, as did the other women. And then we went to the men's prisons. So we did 8 performances in the men's prisons. Bearing in mind, we had never been in a men's prison before. So we went into the men's prisons and it was like we were working with men saving life for really hard crimes. And then people on remand, you know, so it was a bit like doing the making of the play. We just took every day as it came when we were on the tour, not thinking anything outside the project at all. And then we went to live theatre and we put it up on the stage. And the women, you'll see the actors, they're just in greys, they're just in grey tracksuits. And we had lights for the first time, we had a sound system for the first time, and it was beautiful. And you could hear the women as if they'd just flown over the razor wire and they were inside the theatre. And we were all going, oh, I could even feel tearful now thinking about it. Because me and Laura were sitting there going, oh my God, the women are literally on stage. And it is a beautiful piece of theatre. 19 years, we have never done a play that's 1 hour, with no set, with just tape and 3 chairs. And we sat as an organisation, our board of trustees, and went, this could be the play we could take to the Edinburgh Festival. And we'd never been before, never performed it before. We were supported by Northern Stage. We had a really good venue, a good team, but we had no idea what was going to happen next. And then the reviews came in. And then we got, 4 stars, and then we got 5 stars. And then we got the phone call from America, who'd been shortlisted for the Carol Tamber Best of Edinburgh Award, and if you win, you'll end up in New York. The night before the ceremony, we went into a women's prison in Edinburgh. We went into a prison called Cumberton Vale, and we went in, and which was really good for us as a company, because we'd been in the Edinburgh Festival, and I'd gone and done workshops in refuges while we were there. We'd made sure we'd invited everybody who had an interest in alternatives to prison for women, and had come as audiences, so politically we were kind of moving in that kind of area while we were there. But we went to this women's prison in Cumberton Vale, and it was just like a breath of fresh air. It was like going back to Lower Newton Prison. These women were going, oh, there's my life on stage. Oh, there's me. And we went to the ceremony the next day, and And then it got announced when we won, and then we all went up on stage, and it was just pure magic. And then the hard work happened. Then we had to then make New York. And it's a Cinderella story in lots of ways, but it was hard work. But we did what we do here, is we linked everybody that we could, and we just started to network and squirrel around in New York, and then we got those audiences in as well as theatre-going audiences in New York. We got all of those people, but we had reviews in every night. Same time as all this happening, the professor over there is trying to get us into a prison in New York, in Connecticut. And then the New York Times came through, and our sponsor's Carol Tambor, she said, did you see you got the critic's pick? I had no idea what that meant, really, at all. Kind of going, oh, okay. But then we got into the prison in Connecticut, and that was just the highlight. The girl didn't know the content of the play. There's drug smuggling in there. It's set inside a prison. There's strong language. It's the women's point of view of prison. It's a show that really shouts their voices, hears their voices. So we kind of, the actors are on stage, the governor doesn't know what's going on. We like kind of stood at the back. As soon as the performance starts, like Colton Vale and, like, you know, a lot of community audiences that we meet with, it's an interaction. So they kind of go on into that. Respect. Yeah. Because one of the actors goes in, characters goes, I wish I was treated with respect, and they go on into that. And then there's the moment when the women are put in segregation, and then one of the women goes, this shit is global. And that became the tagline for us while we were there, and has since, because it's universal, because they've experienced domestic violence, it's linked to prison. What it feels like when you're in prison is felt across the world. So we kind of knew that it translated over to America and to those women. And we connected then New York to Edinburgh, to the Northeast, and we felt really proud of that connection. And we could hear all the voices. Then after New York, we came back to London in prison. And then we shared that story with Love Noon, and we've continued to go back and forward with Love Noon. With Key Change, I think we did the national tour, so we got our national tour, our first national tour, went to the House of Parliament. We were looking at a white paper at the time about reform in prison, so we were kind of in that moment, and, you know, and that was like a total honour. And then we did the national tour, and it, you know, the actors will tell you that when they went round, they didn't only get a standing ovation for the show, but they got a standing ovation for the post-show. So the politics behind it, the process to make the show, the stories of the women. And now we're about to go global. So it's the same thing. It's squirreling away in New York. We're squirreling away in the world now. So we've kind of got all the academics working with us. And we've got different partners, people who like the art as well. So it's not, even though I talk very passionately about the piece and the issues in the piece, the art is beautiful. It's a stunning piece of theatre. We've got it going to Adelaide, we've got it in America, we've got it in the Solomon Islands. So people are hosting screenings everywhere, and people are embedding it in their websites. So the United Nations Women are embedding it in their website, the Penal Reform International are, the British Council are. I mean, it's just like a long list of people. So with the trailer alone, we've reached 14,000 people. We estimate maybe 100,000 people will see it. But potentially, if everybody watches it, wherever it's embedded, then potentially we've got over 1 million people being able to see Key Change. And it's not only about seeing the art, it's about joining in that debate. It's about going, because it's part of, it's marking the United Nations campaign to end violence against women and girls, the 16 days of activism leading up to the 10th of December. And it's about contributing to that big debate. And the debate, you know, the United Nations are saying it, we need to think that domestic violence is inevitable, that's preventable, and it needs to be positive conversation, not just about the reality of what it is, which is one thing, but also then even just reading that and knowing that it's preventable. Like, I don't even know whether we've got that in our heads. I think a lot of the time we feel it's just part of us, or it's part of our world that we live in. After 19 years, I still want my jaw to drop every time I hear about it. I still want to feel that rage that it happens in somebody else's life to their children and to them on all levels. I kind of then go, this needs to stop. 1 in 3 across the world experience it. And you just go, why do people feel entitled to do that to another human being? Why do we think that that is just the way it is? But if we don't invest, we will always have domestic violence. We'll always have murder, and we'll always have kids being made as kids into that threat from people who are supposed to love them.
Do you think there's a lot of life in the play yet?
So it goes out now for 16 days, but also somebody has just bought the rights to the script in Los Angeles. There's women in Los Angeles who are going to perform it, so that's going to happen next year. There's loads of schools going to be watching it now, and loads of educational establishments watching it now. then we want to talk about how it can be part of the national curriculum, because we're being asked about that. I don't really know what's next, other than I just really hope that it reaches a million. I hope people watch it across the world. I would like it to be really important. We're in that, we're really in a special moment, a very unique moment, and I really hope that this becomes even more special with this 16 days, the 25th of November, 10th of December.
So that was the brilliant Katrina McHugh, and if you'd like to see Key Change, it's going to be streamed live to audiences across the world at 7 p.m. on November the 25th to mark the United Nations campaign to end violence against women. It will also be available to watch online throughout the UN's 16 Days of Activism campaign, which goes on from the 25th of November until the 10th of December. You can find the film at Open Clasp's website, which is openclasp.org.uk/productions/key-change, and there's also going to be a string of live events all over the world, so keep an eye out for those.
You play ball like a girl!
Go on, do one, kid. Jenny off the blocks.
Welcome to Jenny Off the Blocks, that part of the week where we jump on the runners and speed through the labyrinth of oppression as we talk all things women's sport. And yes, I did Google bobsleigh terminology this morning. We've got a lot to get through this week, so let's crack on. First up, this morning we awoke to the sad news about the death of Wimbledon champion Jana Novotná, who had been suffering from cancer. She won Wimbledon back in 1998, I believe, but this is the enduring image of her, which you may or may not know, was after losing the Wimbledon final, I think in 1992 or 1993, and having a little bit of a cry about it and being counselled by the Duchess of Kent, who said to her, maybe not now, but, you know, your time's going to come. And indeed it did. So obviously that's very sad news, and we wish her family well. The Mark Sampson effect continued to rumble on in women's football this week. In fairness, not that we particularly feel the need to spare Sampson, but this is actually the Lee Kendall effect and very much the Football Association effect. But anyway, so anyone listening to this podcast on a regular basis will know all about this, but a brief summary for any newbies. The England women's football manager, Mark Sampson, was sacked a month or so ago after the FA found a review which was conducted about a previous role but took place very much while he was the England manager, into safeguarding concerns related to him, which found that while he did not pose any risk, they did uncover evidence of inappropriate and unacceptable behaviour with female players. But this came after he'd already twice been found to have, I don't know, innocent, or I think the wording was there were no wrongdoings on his part, against allegations of using racially discriminatory language against players Ennio Luco and Drew Spence, which he was then subsequently found very much to be guilty of and had to apologise for. And the FA have faced criticism from pretty much everyone over this absolute clusterfuck, which also, by the way, involved paying Aluko a fuck ton of cash to keep quiet about it. But it went on. The team's goalkeeping coach, Lee Kendall, who was also investigated after it alleged he'd spoken to Aluko, who is of Nigerian heritage, in a mock Caribbean accent, which, well, I mean, Jesus. Aluko had said she thought he was ignorant rather than deliberately offensive, but that it was worth highlighting the culture within the organisation, and, you know, absolutely fair play. So Kendall resigned from his post last week, curiously, after the FA said no further action would be necessary, having concluded a four-week investigation into his conduct, though the statement neglected to mention that Kendall had in fact admitted to the accusations against him. So when asked by The Guardian to explain why they omitted this information from their statement and if it was intended to effectively cover up behaviour by one of their coaches, they declined to comment, according to the newspaper. So it's kind of incredible, really. I mean, who is doing the FA's comms/policy/all work? Have they spent so much money on legal fees that the entire backroom staff consists of ferrets dancing on a keyboard while Martin Glenn and Greg Clark just cross their fingers and hope for the best? Or is the organisation so arrogant that it just has zero fucks to give about the pretty serious allegations against them? It sort of, I don't know, for me it really raises interesting questions about policing the police, I suppose, which we'll all remember from a lovable rogue, in inverted commas, Sepp Blatter's time as the head of FIFA. Clearly, what we're looking at here is not a democracy and, well, you all know how that ends. Well, at least Robert Mugabe does, but anyway. It's not just shit for the players, but it also undermines their achievements because it deflects attention from the huge steps that have been made in women's football in the last couple of years, as Wales women's coach Jane Ludlow pointed out this week. But some happier news. The Rugby Football Union announced a new payment structure this week for match and training fees for England's women's players taking part in the Autumn International Series against Canada. So that deal includes match and training fees for all players involved in the 15s games, despite it having been announced earlier this year that they would no longer be employed by the RFU with under full-time contracts. So the decision was made by the RFU to focus more on the rugby sevens game instead because that's an Olympic sport now. So I guess, you know, I don't know. I think in some respects that kind of makes sense. It gets more attention. It's a better platform for women. But obviously pretty shit for the others. But anyway, I mean, this is good news, right? That someone's decided that their players still deserve to be paid for doing a job. But it's still not a contract, is it? I mean, someone should probably tell the RFU about that zero-hour contract shit. Like, you know, it's really bad, guys, actually. Bad, yeah. Especially when it's being reported that a bird is going to get paid between £4,000 to £5,000 for a test, while a guy is getting up to £22,000 for a test. Bitch, please, come on. That is more than a 9.1% difference. Apparently, most of us ladies work for over a month for free in a year, compared to our male counterparts, that is. Ladies, you are working three quarters of the fucking year for zip. I'm kind of sick of bad news now, so I'm not going to dwell on it too much. Or, in fact, on England losing the Ashes to Australia, or rather, Australia retaining the Ashes because they weren't technically ours to lose in the first place. So let's end with some good news, which is that the International Olympic Committee and UN Women have renewed their already five-year partnership on sport for gender equality, which aims to empower women and girls through sport and increase women's leadership and gender equality. The UN Women Executive Fumzile Malambo Nukuka said, that is a horrible pronunciation, I'm sure, so sorry about that. She said, sport is an invaluable tool to equip women and girls with leadership skills, reduce marginalisation and dismantle stereotypes. Together, we can bring substantive equality to the world of sport at all levels. And I am very hopeful that someone will be telling the RFU and indeed the FA about this. A massive shout out, while we're on good news, to the Nigerian women's bobsleigh team who qualified for the Pyeongchang Olympics last week, which had sports journalists everywhere flapping about cool runnings as if they hadn't just reported on Eni Aluko and Lee Kendall. We assume they mean in a triumph over adversity kind of a way, as opposed to not understanding the difference between Nigeria and Jamaica kind of a way. The victory makes them the first ever African team to contest the bobsleigh and the first ever Nigerian team to take part at a Winter Olympics, which is obviously tremendous stuff, so well done. Finally, a huge congratulations to 56-year-old Gina O'Keefe, the mother of standard-issued listener Rosemary O'Keefe, who won medals aplenty alongside teammate Jenny Whitcomb at the International Kettlebell Lifting Championships last week. The team travelled all the way to Seoul in South Korea at their own expense in order to compete, so that's got to be worthy of a resounding big up. That's it from me this week. I'll be back in a couple of weeks' time, and hopefully, fingers crossed, I won't have anything to say about the Football Association next time. If you've got anything you want us to cover in terms of sport or any opinions you want to put out there, then give me a shout. I'm on the Twitter at InspireGen. Speak to you. Oh, no, not speak to you. Yeah. Thanks.
Welcome to Dunleavy Does Disney. Dunleavy, what Disney did you do this week?
This week, in honour of St Andrew's Day, I watched 2012's Brave, which is one of Disney's films made through Pixar animations, which is actually the first one of the Pixar Disney films that we've done in Dunleavy Does Disney.
It is, isn't it?
To be clear, it's not the first one that was made. Mm-hmm. It's just the first one that we've done.
Was Toy Story the first one made? I think Toy Story is the first
possibly
one.
Possibly Toy Story. Have you guys seen it?
None.
Yes, I have seen it and I am still smiling. Did you like it?
You know what? I loved it. I really, really did. And I know that you might be thinking it's because it's Pixar, and Pixar films are different to traditional Disney films because they have the sort of humour that's like actually funny, and they remember that there are adults watching and try to cater to it. Mm-hmm. But actually, of all the Pixar films I've seen, this is the most recognisably Disney of them. In that it has
sort of a princess.
Yeah, it has a princess, and it has sort of the sort of formulaic like storyline telling, and it has the music in a certain places. Whereas a lot of things like Toy Story and Cars and Finding Nemo, they function much more as sort of ensemble. Like, I know ensemble sounds like a ridiculous word to use when you talk about animation.
No, it's true.
But there are a lot of characters that are integral to it, whereas Disney films traditionally have, you know, just the sort of the one story that's going through it, and that's it. So it is the most Disney, but obviously that doesn't mean that's a bad film, you know. Because since I started doing this, I've actually had a couple of people say to me, "Oh, I need to. I've got a kid tonight. I'm looking after," or you know, "I've got a friend that's really into Disney films, like, and they want me to watch one with them. Like, what's the most bearable out of all of them?" And I've been saying, you know, like Pinocchio.
Pinocchio.
The Rescuers. But I would certainly add Brave to that list. But actually, more than that, I'd say if you actually ever find yourself with nothing to do, you don't have to have a kid in the room, find yourself with nothing to do and you come across Brave, child or not, watch it, because it is completely charming.
I've got to say, it's become one of my favourite films. I absolutely fell in love with it. It was just wonderful and fierce and followed brilliant women who wanted to forge their own path.
Yeah.
And it's just a remarkable film.
Well, I'm not going to do too much of a plot description because that would take up too much time. But the long and the short of it...
Jen, you're looking very confused,
mate.
Well,
I'm fucking seeing it, so, you know.
Okay, well, the long and the short of it is it's set in medieval Scotland, and it's about a teenage girl who doesn't want to get married.
Oh.
Which isn't just revolutionary for Disney. It's actually pretty revolutionary, full stop.
I thought you were going to say for Scotland.
No, full stop. I was genuinely sitting here thinking of other pieces of fiction that has, as its central premise, a girl who doesn't want to get married. And the only one I could think of, I mean, there might be more, people can like tweet me if they want to say it, the only one I could think of was Jamaica Inn, which I've talked about this before, I bloody loved as a teenager, precisely because it was about a woman who wanted to live outside of the gender norms. So to see that in a Disney film is pretty startling. The other thing that's quite extraordinary about Brave, certainly for a Disney film, is that it's about mothers and daughters. Most Disney films, the mother has been removed from the picture. She's like either dead before it starts, like The Little Mermaid, Pocahontas, or she dies during it, like Bambi, or she's removed from the scene of the action, like the mad elephant in Dumbo. But in this, she's not just present. She's absolutely integral to the plot.
In fact, no one dies at the beginning. Well, that's a big thing with Disney films, that someone dies. And you kind of think someone might have done, because it's like they're playing on their own trope, and then the little rug pulls, and it's all right. He's just got a pirate leg now.
Yeah. And another great thing about this film is that Merida, the princess, although when said with a Scottish accent, it does slightly sound like murder. Murder. There's been a murder.
She's been in Taggart quite a lot,
Oh, my God, I promise not a shit Scottish accent, but there you go.
We've all failed on that. Sorry.
She's the princess, Merida the princess, and her mother, the queen, are played by Kelly MacDonald and Emma Thompson. Now, I would actually watch any film that was the premise, even if the age gap isn't necessarily what it should be. Fun fact here, Merida was supposed to be played by Rhys Shearsmith. No, that would be hilarious.
That'd be weird.
By Reese Witherspoon. But she dropped out when she didn't feel that her Scottish accent was up to scratch, which is actually really laudable, and it's frankly something that should happen more often in Hollywood. Kevin Costner should have said, "Hey, dudes, I'm not getting this accent right. Perhaps I'll get someone else."
Oh, no, but I love Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
I'll not allow this running to proceed. Sorry, actual Scottish man.
Let's go to Nottingham.
So then the role went to Kelly MacDonald, who we all know is absolutely tremendous, and certainly to my mind, she is the best actress ever to play a Disney princess.
She's great. She's just, it's just great. It's hard to say anything other than it's fucking brilliant.
I mean, she looks wildly different as well, in as much as she is actually a fucking state most of the time. She really is. She has a lot of crap in her hair. She has got tears in her dress. She is not immaculately presented.
She doesn't like it when they put her in a pretty dress. No. She is not happy about it.
More importantly, I mean, she has her own agency. Like, we've said that about women in Disney films before, but she's good at a lot of stuff, and it's stuff that's mostly shown in Disney films as boy stuff, like climbing, horse riding, archery. But I think the best example of it is she gets trapped in a tower at some point, which is a Disney trope. Does she wait for someone to come and save her? No, she sets about smashing the shit out of the door herself with a poker in an attempt to get out, which is, like I say, about the most laudable message sent to girls in a Disney film ever. So, yeah, hooray for Kelly MacDonald, hooray for Emma Thompson. The rest of the cast is pretty great too. Julie Walters is there, Billy Connolly's there, Kevin McKidd is there.
Julie Walters?
Julie Walters is the witch.
Of course,
they've got Scottish accents, so you don't always recognise who they are.
And she's not even an evil witch; she's a clever witch.
Yeah.
What I didn't know, which I found out the other day because I was googling Emma Thompson, as you do, is that she is sort of Scottish herself.
Is she?
Yeah, her mum is Scottish, and she apparently spends like half her time in Scotland, and basically has done like her entire life. So she's sort of Scottish.
Well, her accent as Eleanor is pretty flawless.
Mm, yeah,
great. Well, that's why.
Yeah. And actually, like, another thing about Brave is the parents are like a reasonable age difference to the child.
Yeah.
To the children. Billy Connolly is the dad. So when Hannah had said, "Oh, I'm going to watch Brave this time," and I said, "Oh, it's the one set in Scotland," she said, "Yeah." And I went, "Is Billy Connolly in it?" She was like, "Of course he is." And I was like, "Okay." And he's the dad. And Emma Thompson's the mum. And they're not great. Queen Eleanor's got a grey streak, a classy grey kind of Bride of Frankenstein streak. But apart from that, they're not like Mrs. Potts. They're not 105 and their kid's 4.
They could legitimately have spawned a child of the age. Yeah.
And there's actually proper love and affection and romance shown between the parents still, which is really lovely too, to the point where the kids are like, stop it, Mum, stop it, Dad, which is pretty cute.
They want her to get married. Mm.
Well, the dad's not as bothered. He's kind of like, he's more supportive of her being what would have, in previous days, been called a tomboy, I suppose.
They're trying to force her into an arranged marriage as such, which is the point.
Mm. And to keep all the clans from going to war together. And like, to go to war against each other.
The princes that turn up, the selection, it is really funny.
They're hilarious.
I have to say, it is. There's a lot of brawling and drinking.
I wonder what Scottish people think of it.
I don't know. It does feel affectionately done, and it does. I don't think it's specifically Scottish. I mean, if you look at things like, you know, Game of Thrones and Lord of the Rings, there's always that kind of medieval, all men must be drinking mead and fighting.
I was just
attitude.
Thinking it's kind of a cross between Highlander and Game of Thrones.
Yeah, but with none of the filthy stuff. Even though I think Mumford and Sons were actually involved in some of the music.
Sorry, what?
That doesn't even spoil it for me, which is quite something.
And we've talked so long and we have still not mentioned the fact that there were bears in it.
Yeah.
Amazing bears. And the animation wise, the hair and the fur is just incredibly.
I want to know if she got married or not, because I'm assuming eventually they just fucking make her get married anyway.
No, she
is
changes.
That the spoiler?
She changes tradition. She actually breaks tradition and says, "I'm going to break with tradition." And her and her mum, between them, after a big old adventure and, well, mid adventure. Yeah. She breaks with tradition and goes, "I'm not going to do this anymore. We're going to stop." And they stop the patriarchy.
Does she sit in a press conference and say, "I'm not going to be the person people
expect me to be
anymore"?
It's kind of a press conference. Yeah. It's like she stands up amid the
is
brawling.
Is it loosely based on the Martin Scorsese Chanel
advert?
I don't think so.
No. Okay. But, I mean, she does. It's important to say, like, actually the difference with Jamaica Rain is Jamaica Rain, her point was she never wanted to get married. That's not quite her point here. Her point is she didn't want to get married, A, now, and B, to somebody that she wasn't of her choosing.
Mm.
So you would think, back in the day, Disney would have done this thing where there had been a fourth option, you know, who turned up late and revealed himself to actually be, like, a prince. And they would go, great, and they would get married. You know, the idea of Belle.
Yeah.
Belle spent all her time going, "Oh, I want to go into the Great Wide Open." 3 days later, she's living in a castle with some guy and married, and it's, like, boring. So all of that nonsense is dispensed with. Actually, I have another fun fact which just makes me love this film even more. Merida, but she is now a Disney princess, mm-hmm. right? So Disney said, okay, in that case, we're going to put her on our merchandising, you know, on our Disney, like, merchandising. Here are the princesses. She will be on it. And when they did that, she was what I can only describe as tamed, as in her hair was less curly and she was thinner. And there was a campaign to say, hey, Disney, fuck that, which included the film's director, who is a woman, Brenda Chapman, and Disney actually backed down and changed it. So well done, those women. And that does give you hope that there is a different
Disney.
Yeah, coming.
Although,
possibly.
Brave is before Frozen, right?
Brave is before Frozen.
Because Merida is, I mean, she's still skinny. She's a teenage girl. And yeah. She's depicted as skinny with wild red hair. But she's fit and strong and active and runs around yeah. and does stuff. And she's still got, like, the tiny nose and the big eyes. But yeah. she just seems more real, if that doesn't sound yeah. ridiculous about a cartoon character. And Eleanor seems... Eleanor, again, is she's a slim woman. The men, actually, they go to town a bit. They're the ones with all the caricatures. Yeah. Like, the Billy Connolly character, the king, is just... He's just a barrel
yeah.
with one wooden
with
leg.
With two really small legs, one yeah, of which is made of wood. One.
Yeah. And the princes are all ridiculous looking.
Yeah.
The one who you... There's one, and he's so... I'm going to say sort of so Glaswegian that you can't understand a word he says. And even his dad's like, all right, son.
Oh, that's... Is that not... I think that's Kevin McKidd.
Is that Kevin McKidd?
Okay, there's one that Kevin McKidd plays the dad and the...
And the kid.
And the kid. And I do like a bit of Kevin McKidd. He's really good.
Oh, it's just such a wonderful, heartwarming film that lets the women, one, take control and, two, win and not have to be owned by a man or given to a man.
Yeah.
They've all got their own
And also
agency.
It demonstrates that, you know, to be honest, when I was a 16-year-old girl, I had a pretty fucking stressful relationship with my mum. That's the thing that happens.
Yeah.
Mothers have their ideas about what they want. I mean, maybe it doesn't happen in every family. I don't know. But there is something. And when you look at so many Disney films that are about male bonding, you know, something like Finding Nemo, which is essentially about male bonding, or mm-hmm. about the idea that fathers and sons rut up against, like, butt up against each other. Not rut up.
That's a very different, very different film, that one.
But actually, it's a film that genuinely, like, acknowledges that mothers and daughters have really complex relationships, and that's...
On yeah. both sides, and yeah. both sides need to listen.
Yeah.
It's just a fantastic film. I immediately recommended it to someone on Twitter who said they were poorly. Did anyone have any Netflix series? I'm like, have you seen Brave? Watch that. And she was like, all right, I will yeah. do. It's great.
So I'm sorry, Jen, that I've made you sit through shit films, and you missed out on watching a good one.
It's all right, mate. The internet still exists, you know. Yeah. We'll true. Be okay.
I just... It feels a bit sad that they made Brave and then... Knowing that that was in 2012 and the couple of the ones that have come after it, it's like, oh, it's almost like, you know, when they go, oh, can we do this film festival? And they go, oh, no, we covered women last year.
Yeah.
It's like, has Disney done women now? That's it. Well, we did one that was, you know.
Frozen did have a fairly positive message, which was, be nice to your sister and don't expect a man to save you,
just
which I don't think I can criticise them
let
for.
Let down by the insipid music, though.
Yeah, that's
there's
true.
Not, I mean,
let it go, Mick.
What score are we giving it?
I'm going to give it 5.
Yay! 5 what?
I'm going to give it 5. Why don't people talk about this film more out of 5? Hello. Welcome to the bit where we say goodbye from the Standard Issue podcast. Thanks very much for listening. Today, the role of complete inconvenience while I'm trying to record this will be played by Peggy. Next week's podcast, if you're interested, and I can't see why you wouldn't be, is a live recording of our show that we did at the Leicester Square Theatre in October, when our guests were the very funny Scarlett Moffat, the completely brilliant Rebecca Front, and rising star comedian Evelyn Mock. And we had a really funny, really interesting conversation. So listen out next week. If you enjoyed that little snippet of Jen's interview with the actress Susan Wacoma you listened to earlier, be aware that a full version of that will be uploaded on Sunday as our Sunday Chops. So that's something to look out for in the meanwhile. And the following week, which is, I don't know, it's probably December. Ooh, I would check, but I don't want to think about that. Yeah, the following week, we're back as a podzine. And among our guests, we have the very funny women from the Outlander podcast, which is Maureen Younger and Jen Brister, whose name might ring a bell to regular Standard Issue readers / listeners. We had a fine old time with them. Quick moment to say thanks for everyone who was involved in our International Men's Day gig on Sunday and helped us raise some money for the men's charity Calm. So thanks to everyone who turned up as a member of the audience, thanks to our brilliant guests, and also thanks to the nice people of Calm who came and shook some buckets and, yeah, hopefully raised some cash. If you're interested in coming to our other events at the Leicester Square Theatre, you're going to need to buy a ticket soon, because the December event and the January event are both selling really fast, and it's quite probably because we've got some terrific guests. And in December, that's we've got two great actresses, Saran Jones and Stephanie Beecham, plus the writer Jojo Moyes and the guilty feminists Deborah Frances White. And in January, we have Jennifer Saunders, Joe Wiley and Joe Caulfield. I know, fuck me. They are both really great lineups. But if you don't live in London, maybe you possibly live near Cambridge, and we have a gig coming up in Cambridge, January the 19th at the Junction. We have two guests confirmed so far. They are the actress, activist and very funny woman Liz Carr, and also the poet and activist and very lovely woman Holly McNish. So, yeah, get a ticket book for that now if you can. I'm going to go because it's incredibly hot under this duvet, so much so that the expression stay frosty seems absolutely preposterous. But there you have it. Until next week, stay frosty.
Standard Issue, for all women.